Welcome to ITE 1, Module 11, Part 1, because there's no way we're finishing this in more than, or in less than one go. So this will be Part 1. I want to congratulate Drew, who has basically graduated as of yesterday. The only reason he has not actually, I've not hit the graduate button on him is because he has a few drills that he wants to do for A-plus certification, so we're going to let him take some exams that don't actually count with very little time on the clock and see how he does. So, congratulations, Drew! You've graduated for the second time!
Yay!
Yay for me!
I do my own fanfare.
Yeah, that's true.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I stayed up till like 3 o'clock in the morning to do it, and then I had to get up at like 8 to do O&M. So, our lesson was a special one.
I'm sure.
You also have the pleasure of actually having somebody here now who can officially give you some tips on the final, because I really couldn't tell you what I thought of the final because I'm your instructor. So if you want to talk a little bit to people about the final, Drew, that would be cool.
I honestly got a lower score when I took the final last time, which would be expected, I mean, because I know the material, but they're very different. It's a lot simpler. It seemed to me anyway to be a lot simpler. A fair few of simple questions and a lot more of not quite as simple questions with very obviously wrong answers.
How long did it take you to do, Drew?
It took me like an hour to do, but that's because I was spending most of it, just having fun at its expense. I could probably have done it in half that time if I was really like concentrating and doing absolutely nothing but just click, click, click.
He was reading me some of the questions, and we were talking about answers that people should not put down if they didn't want to instantly fail the course, because some of the questions were just that bad.
Yeah, I feel strongly that there are a few answers that should just cause you to fail if you put them down.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, no. It's not anything like last year's final. Final was a lot of critical thinking.
I'm trying to recall an example.
Practice final was hard, too.
The practice final is harder, I think, than the actual
final. Yeah, I recall the practice final being harder than the actual final last semester, too.
It definitely is in Discovery. That's a really hard practice final, and you get to the final, and you're like, what?
Maybe that's what it was, yeah.
But no, this final, less critical thinking questions, a lot more, you know, basic general computer knowledge, more soft skills.
There were a couple that just seemed to be a grammar test.
yeah, a little of that too.
Just a hint, guys, you need to know your terminology. The test is very based on terminology. So when it may ask you what is the copper / aluminium thing that sits between the CPU and the fan, you'd want to say heat sink.
That's not on the final.
No, that's not.
No, that's just an example of a question.
But it's an example. He's,
yeah.
This course has been always very vocabulary specific, which is important because you have to actually know what you're talking about and sound like you know what you're talking about, and do both of them at the same time.
Yep. If you want to go at the practice final, if anyone does, write me and I will activate it for a week. You get a week to do it. You get you're going to get an hour and 15 minutes to do the practice final. You get 3 hours to do the real final, but we're going to shorten up the time for the practice final because a lot of you are going for A+. So this is practice for that.
It's worth mentioning that we do have retake options for the practice final. So if you do bomb it the first time, you can do it again. And if you really, really need more time, you can have it. So
absolutely. And it's worth mentioning that the practice final doesn't count for any percentage of your grade whatsoever.
Yeah, Grace made it not count for any marks at all.
Well, you know, practices tend to, well, never mind.
No, actually, in Cisco curriculum, it's worth the same as a regular exam, which I thought was stupid, so I made the put that into your lab marks, and your final exam actually doesn't count for anything, or your practice final doesn't count for anything.
Oh, the final exam better count for something.
Oh, I think that's like 15, 20% of your grade.
How much is the final? It's like 30% of the whole, like, it's huge.
Something like that. It is huge.
Is anybody finding Grace a bit quiet, or are we enjoying that?
Just a bit. Just a little. Just to remind people that you only get 8-hour window to take the final in once you finally decide to do it.
Yeah,
when you must email the instructors and give them a time window of when it wants to be active. If you want your instructors to be happy with you, that should be in Perth time. If you don't, then you can give it in your local time. But please specify which time zone you're giving it in. And you have 8 hours to actually start the final. Once you start the final, you've got as long as the time you've got in the final to complete it. If you don't catch that 8-hour time window, the test has to be reactivated. This is not a problem, but it is worth mentioning that it is a little bit more painful to activate the final than it is to activate the other exams. So please try to be available for your time window, although we do understand that life does happen.
In fact, actually, that won't be a problem because we're doing the same thing we did last year. You will be on Skype or Ventrilo with somebody when you take your exam, in case there's any problems with you getting locked out of the exam, in case you need clarification on any questions, and honestly, just,
it is helpful.
You know. So we will be here on Ventrilo or Skype, whichever you choose, to sit with you during the exam, unless for some reason we really can't. And
that was amusing when, I remember you were putting groceries away, but you were still paying attention.
So just let us know when you're ready. Take the final, and we will get that going for you.
Not to totally switch gears, the HTML curriculum is up to 12, or 11, right?
Yep.
Yes. I'll throw diagram descriptions in tomorrow. I need to make a note to myself to do it tomorrow afternoon, because...
Okay.
So, yeah, I went looking for 12 to do the test the other day. I was like, it's not here! Oh, God!
12 isn't safe.
It's not in there yet.
No, it's not in there yet.
There's always the Flash curriculum if you're brave.
It's actually not.
Yeah.
Well, it is. Kind
Firefox
of
doesn't like that.
It's interesting.
Makes me be able to move tabs and do everything else.
IE is what you should be using.
Anyway, let's start with our lecture, because we've got lots of stuff to get through. Remember chapters 1 through 3? Yeah, that was from the beginning of the semester. You know what we're going to do now? Review them. This is Module 11, which is called Advanced Bench Tech. Really should be called, we're reviewing 1 through 3, because you probably didn't get it the first time. So, this is a chapter that focuses on a lot of upgrading a customer's hardware, which is something you may need to do when in your job. It's something you probably will need to do in your job quite a bit. Until this year, A-plus certification was divided into three specialties. These were field remote and bench technicians. Most technicians' jobs fall into one of these three categories or are a mixture of both. It used to be that you would have to take the A-plus essentials exam and then one of the three specialist exams and in order to become A-plus certified. Now they don't specialize, you just take the A-plus essentials and practical application tests. So we'll go quickly over what these specialties are so you can think about what type of job you might want. We've got, someone's going to say something, go ahead. What were you going to say? Okay, I thought somebody had picked up the microphone. All technicians will need the skills of building and upgrading computers, performing installations, installing, configuring, and optimizing software, performing preventative maintenance, troubleshooting, and repairing computers, and communications. But it depends on which job you take, how much of these skills and how well developed these skills you'll actually need. Okay, so a field technician works repairing computers on site. You may work for one company repairing all their computers, or you might be sent out to many different companies to work. You're going to need excellent troubleshooting and customer service skills because you're regularly in contact with the customers. The advantage here, you get to physically touch the computers. The disadvantage here, you actually have to dress very professionally because you are in the field. A remote technician.
So you have to have
be...
appropriate social skills.
Yes, you definitely do. A help desk, a remote technician will be your help desk technician. They need excellent customer service, and they're not going to get access to the physical computer. So they have to be able to ask the customer the right questions and walk them through verbally or with written instructions how to fix that computer, unless they're lucky enough to have remote software to get this done. So you may be able to work at home, or you may be working in an organization. So your actual physical appearance, although important, is not, you're going to be a little possibly less stringent than the field technician, but you have no physical access to the computers. We've got our bench tech. This is what you'd really think of as the real nerds of the technical people. They're in their lairs, and they've got these computers laid out in front of them on the benches, and they may work in a large depot or workshop doing warranty repairs on a large number of computers. You'll have limited customer interaction. You won't be talking too much to the customers. You're just taking their computers into the workshop and repairing them and passing them back to the salesperson who helps out your customers. Any questions on the three types of customer service jobs? Is anyone awake?
Yeah, they seem pretty straightforward.
All right. We have a quick review of safety. General rules include keep the work area clean and free from clutter, keep food and drink out of the work area, never open a computer monitor unless you have been properly trained, remove all jewelry and watches, make sure that the power is off and that the power plug has been removed, really important. Do not look into the laser beams located in the computer equipment. Make sure that there is a fire extinguisher and first aid kit available. Cover sharp edges with tape when working inside the computer case. Use anti-static mats and pads to reduce the chance of ESD damage to your computer equipment. Store hazardous and toxic materials in a secure cabinet. Keep the floor clear of anything that might trip someone. Clean work areas on a regular basis. You should use caution when you move a computer equipment from one place to another. Can anyone tell me the correct way to pick up a heavy piece of computer equipment?
Carefully. Carefully.
No.
Carefully.
More specific. Bend at the knees, not at the back. Or don't use your knees. You don't want to hurt your back, so yeah, bend, pick it up, and don't use your back. There's really nice belts that you can actually get, and they are weight belts that will allow you to keep the correct position when you are picking things up, and this can help with the back a lot. So we don't bend at the waist, we bend at the knees, pick it up, and try not to hurt our backs.
Another comment, you were talking about the laser beams and stuff. Just wanted to mention, even if you don't have any sight, you can still, it's still not a great idea to look into the laser beams, you know?
Well, unless you want to drill holes into the back of your eye socket and then possibly into your brain, I wouldn't be looking into laser beams. Because it'll scissor little holes through the back of your eye. And that can be quite
painful. Because
that's
one of those things I've seen people sort of chuckle at that, and I'm like, no.
You know, you really don't want to be, like, super, like, even more blind than you already are. Okay, the other thing you need to make sure to do is explain to your customers who are back in your work area, if you have customers back there, your safety procedures and why they're important. Assure your customers that you are only making these rules for their protection. And make sure that your computer components and cleaners are disposed of according to your local guidelines, or you may be fined. There are organizations that determine the safe working conditions in many countries. Can someone tell me the name of this organization in America? Can anyone tell me the name of this organization in any other country? Occupational Health and Safety Organization?
Oh, in Australia it's WorkSafe.
In America it is OSHA.
They're the ones that go around to look at your computer workstation area and stuff and go, it's going to kill you! And your back is going to fall apart, and the desk is the wrong height, and the lights aren't bright enough, and the mouse is the wrong shape, and there should be 6 buttons on that mouse, and the chair should have weird bendy bits. Yeah, but it's very important, because if they don't do that, the workplace can actually be sued for all of the aforementioned bad things that will happen to you. Anybody had any run-ins with WorkSafe, OH&S people at all?
No, my boss solved that by just not letting me do that work.
Okay, so do you go around to people telling them that the lights aren't bright enough and that the chairs are wrong and all that sort of important stuff?
Well, I'm an OH&S person at work and I should have known the answer to that. And yes, I do point out all the bad stuff to everybody else and they just laugh at me.
Oh, well, they won't laugh when you get sued.
I just put a file note on their record and then they go and do what I told them and the power goes to my head.
Fair enough. Okay, so, there we go. That is occupational health and safety. Always use the right tool for the job. If you need a review of basic tools, hey, there's one in Module 11, or you can go back to Module 2 and learn all about it again there, because it's all there. Cisco says never use magnetic tools. Why not?
Because it can damage... Oh, I'm not supposed to answer that.
Anyone else?
Supposedly erase hard drives.
Whoops, it will supposedly erase hard drive.
Yes, it can.
Actually, it's more things like floppy drives and stuff that are at danger from magnets. Hard drives are at danger, but so are floppy drives. If you stick a magnetic screwdriver near your floppy drive, it is possible to remagnetize the heads, which will do bad things to your floppy disks. I know not many people have floppy disks, but it's worth mentioning. It's also possible that if you have a magnetic screwdriver, you can magnetize bits of metal inside the computer that shouldn't be. So it's probably not a good idea.
Well, as we said in Module 2, we use them. And they can be very helpful for picking up and, you know, keeping hold of screws and everything. So if you do, you're at your own risk, really, but Cisco says you shouldn't.
On the other hand, if it's not your computer, you might not want to take that chance. That's just how I'm thinking.
Absolutely. If you know what you're working with, though, if you're doing like a small netbook cover, you're not really in any danger of that, and it can be just much easier to hold the screws in place and do all that. So honestly, in that case, I would definitely use a magnetic screwdriver just basically so I don't lose any screws.
Although, be aware that a lot of the jeweler's screwdrivers that you get are so definitely not magnetic. And for that reason, because if you're working on netbooks, you're going to be using jeweler's screwdrivers, you're going to be using like a 00 Phillips, there isn't enough area for the magnet to hold onto the screw, so that's why people don't bother magnetizing them.
You mean like the glasses screwdriver?
Yes, like the ones that you use for fixing glasses and stuff. If you're using the little tiny ones to take the little tiny screws out of the netbooks and stuff, the screws are so small that there isn't actually enough area on the actual screw head to actually have enough magnetism to hold the screws to the actual driver. So watch out for that. It can be a little bit difficult to get those to stick to drivers, as I've discovered.
I might be grabbing a sighted person for that one.
A lot of the new netbooks have just regular old Phillips backs.
They're zero Phillips though. They're the little tiny one.
Yeah, but we've got a good... There's a magnetic screwdriver. I've used all those. Anyway, you've also got... This is new for this chapter. It's specialized power and testing tools for hardware devices. We've got a multimeter, a device that measures AC and DC voltage, electrical current, and other cables on electrical or other cable and electrical characteristics. You can get talking multimeters for about $39 on eBay last I checked. Does anyone else know any good reliable sources to get a multimeter? Brian, do you have a multimeter that you use?
I do. I have a talking one that I bought for $39, but it's that Canadian version of Radio Shack brand Nextech that I don't think is available anywhere else in the world. So I'm not sure where you'd get one in other countries.
Okay. Anyone else have any ideas?
I'd really like to know.
Yeah, I think we all have them. No,
sure. I don't have one, but that's why I was wondering eBay. If they're...
I think you can sort of get them on eBay. If you Google talking multimeters, you might find places for them. Really good to have. I'm going to bring one in tomorrow, and Meredith and Carol will get to play with one. Unfortunately, you guys are not here, so...
There is a demo on the website. Yep. I'll find it for people. We actually do have a demo of us playing with the multimeter so that people can hear what it did and stuff, so we'll dig that up.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, oh, it's pretty boring. It's like you hold it to the battery and you press the button and it goes 1.613 volts, and that's about the end of it.
This is pretty neat, though. You guys have a lab for 11. And it is basically listening to the cable testing audio for testing a UTP cable. And instead of doing either of the power testing labs, I want a quick write-up of how you would test a cable and why you might do that. That's it, honestly. That's all you got to do, because we don't have any talking testers or anything to give you guys. Any questions on that?
Now that's different from a voltmeter, though, right? The tester
you're talking about?
No. Cable tester or the multimeter? A voltmeter only tests volts. Multimeter can usually test volts, ohms, amps, although not very many amps.
I broke it. So you're saying the cable tester and the multimeter are not the same?
No, they're not.
No.
The cable tester is that if you listen to the demo, it goes... and it says short between pins 6 and 7. It's actually got an LCD on it and stuff, and it tells you things, whereas a multimeter just does a reading.
So we don't have talking cable testy thing?
Nope.
No, we don't.
Aww. It seems like it wouldn't be that hard voltage? To do.
No, we've got beeping power supply testers, though, which is something I want to get my hands on.
Oh, cool.
That would be very useful.
I mean, in my 15 years of being a technician, I have never used a power supply tester in my life. And like, power supplies are so cheap, you walk down to the swap meet and get another one. But I suppose it'd be kind of a cool thing to have.
Yeah, just for the cool factor, honestly.
I want to find an audible battery tester that won't break my wallet. And
That's your multimeter.
Yeah, okay.
We use multimeters to test batteries all the time. That's what Meredith and I are going to do tomorrow, is test a battery. Or actually, probably her netbook charger. But you can test batteries. That's what they're for.
You also can do limited cable testing with a multimeter by using its continuity indicators, although the little contacts on those RJ45s are pretty small, and you'd have to have really good manual dexterity, which most blind people don't. So you may want to avail yourself of a wire map cable tester with the 8 lights and a light probe.
That's what I really don't... Those are even harder to find, the light probes.
No, they're out there. We can probably find you a link. They're about $60, and they're the size of a pen, and they're around.
I just was saying, because it used to be, like, in the 80s and early 90s, there were scads and scads of them out there, and now there's not nearly as many.
I'm sure that's findable.
It probably is.
Anyway.
There's a company in Denver that makes a good one of that.
Oh, really? Who does that?
I don't remember the name of the company. I'd have to look it up. But it's got two settings and a little tube, so it's, you know, you can actually position it right over one LED instead of getting two or three of them.
If you feel like it, look that up and send a link out to Cavi Discuss. I think a lot of people could use that. Thank you.
Okay.
Just a side note on that. When we do the cut across to the new list server, the mail archives will be secured, so you don't have to be petrified of receiving spam if ever you post to the list, just for people's peace of mind. Well, you can be slightly petrified, but not as petrified as you need to be now.
Okay, we've got the power supply tester. This is a device that checks whether the computer power supply is working properly. A simple power supply tester might just have an indicator lights, while more advanced versions show the amount of voltage and amperage. They also beep, or they can also beep. Cable testers. This is a device that checks wiring shorts or faults, such as wires connected to the wrong pin. And a loopback plug. A device that connects to a computer hub, switch, or router port to perform a diagnostic procedure called a loopback test. Basically, we're making sure that that port works. In a loopback test, the signal is transmitted through a circuit and then returned to the sending device to test the integrity of the data transmission. Gotcha. All right, we're going to have a little quiz on ESD, and we're just going to go right down the row between everybody, and I'm just going to ask you some questions about it. Drew, was there a lot of ESD questions on the actual final?
I, off the top of my head, I can think of 1, 6, 7, and then carry the 9 by the 0.
Okay. Well, we're going to do it anyway. Because
I have
it's
a question for Kim. Well, for him, does anyone remember, and I'm wondering just what kind of device this might have, does anyone remember the Tweedledum from ages ago?
Yes.
What's that?
It's a device
what
that basically
was that a
has,
or just a
no, thing? No. Tweedledum was made by connecting pin 2 to 2 and 3 to 3 on an RS-232 port. A diode was placed on pin 3, and then the results were wired through a piezo speaker so that whenever a character went through an RS-232 port, the Tweedledum would go click and the character would go through in either direction.
It was cool.
And you what was it for?
It's, you could hear basically, serial activity. I've got
yeah,
three
it came
at home.
With the it came with the Blazy interface kit, and that's how I saw it.
Oh, no, we had better ones. We had better
well,
ones.
Well, that's the first
we had
time
really
I saw it.
Big ones with really big speakers that were about the size of a... probably about the size of a quarter on top of it. Mate, this thing had the power.
Oh. I bet that started...
It could tell you, like, if you had a 25-pin serial port, wouldn't it, like, tell you specifically which pin was messing up?
No, that was just the mini tester with lights.
Oh, the, okay. Yeah, that's...
Okay, so we're going to go down the list here, and I think everybody's going to get some kind of question about ESD. So, Brian, quickly, what does ESD stand for?
I have to think.
Okay, we can give you a different question. What is ESD? That might be a better one.
What's that? If I'm thinking of the right thing, it's the high-speed RAM that sort of... interfaces between
no.
the CPU.
No. ESD is electrical static discharge.
No, it's electrostatic discharge.
That's just what I said.
No, you said electrical.
No, you said electrical.
Did I? Okay.
Burn up! I always think it that way, too.
That's okay.
Electrostatic is way cooler.
So, this actually is static electricity that can build up on components. So Curtis, why is it important to protect against ESD?
So you don't damage computer components.
Absolutely, because even a small shock can damage computer components. Drew, can you name a device that we would use to protect against ESD?
Antistatic wrist strap.
Yes.
That's a fun tongue-twisty phrase.
That is. Karen, do you know of another device that might do that?
How about floor mats or a mat under the rubber mats under
yes,
the
absolutely.
Items you're working on?
Yep. Lucy, in the text it says to ground yourself before touching a computer. How is this done?
You can touch the unpainted part inside the computer?
Yes, that's absolutely right. Marshall, what is a component that you should not open because of high high voltage?
Monitor.
Absolutely.
Actually, a CRT monitor.
Oh, either of them you probably don't want to open.
No.
But yeah, CRT monitor.
LCDs don't have high voltage in them.
Yeah, but you probably don't want to be cracking those open either, just...
Well, the panel is sealed, so unless you actually sort of break open the panel, you probably don't want to be cracking them open, but if it's out of warranty and it's just a controller board and you can buy the controller board for $10 from the supplier, you might want to sort of open it up and replace the controller board.
What about the fluorescent tubes for backlits?
I don't know.
I don't think they're high voltage. Still...
You wouldn't think so. They've got materials in them you probably don't want to expose yourself to.
Oh, no. The backlit ones are... if you're talking about the plasma displays, they're not a lot of fun to open. The ones that use cold cathode tubes, though, they're fine. They're just a modular thing.
I was thinking of LCDs.
No, I was thinking about a display on a... Yeah, an LCD display. It has a baby fluorescent tube down at the bottom.
Yeah, a lot of them use cold cathode these days. But yeah, they're pretty safe because it's all sealed in, but you don't really want to be messing with those if you don't have to. There are kits on eBay that will allow you to replace the lights at the bottom of LCD displays and stuff, but it's not something I'd be messing with unless you had to.
One of the things I find annoying about LCDs is I can never tell whether it's off or on. So maybe more need for the light.
Or a little radio.
Yeah.
There's another component that
work with
has
an LCD,
Hubble.
Though?
Yes, it is.
Certainly does.
What does? What did you say?
The radio.
The radio does. Meredith, can you name another component that we might not want to open because of high voltage? What? They took your what? Oh, okay, well, how about a power supply? You don't want to stick your hands in that, for sure, unless you want them fried. So, or are properly trained, you guys probably won't be ever receiving that sort of training because it is very vision intensive. So, we're probably not going to be repairing power supplies or any of that.
There's one more. Does anybody know the final one?
Yeah. That'd be Randy if you know. Do you know?
Laser printers?
Yes! Absolutely.
Yay!
I want to set my laser printer to stun.
You can only do.
It's like what Buzz Lightyear in this thing.
Ian says that's easy to do. You can take the cover off.
Wow.
So, another little incentive not to take apart a power supply. Honestly, repairing a power supply these days is going to be as expensive, probably more expensive, than seriously throwing the thing, well, not throwing it out, taking it to an authorized collection center or disposing of it properly and buying a new one. So you're going to definitely want to buy a new one if you can, rather than repairing it. If you did have that training, you would also know that you never wear an anti-static strap when working with these devices, because you will become the ground and all of that nice voltage will go right through you. So we don't want that. The internal components of a monitor cannot be repaired, but they can be replaced by someone who is properly trained and certified. So you may actually be able to get your monitors repaired.
Here's a concept, though, guys. If you've got LCD monitors and stuff, a lot of them have a pickup and return to base warranty and stuff. We had an Acer monitor die, and the courier bloke came and picked up the monitor, and then 24 hours later, the courier guy came and dropped off a new one. So keep an eye open for the warranty terms on your monitor, because you might not even have to worry about it.
And honestly, if you can not worry about it, don't. That's what these people are there for.
Has anyone still got a CRT, just out of morbid curiosity?
I think we do, don't we?
I do.
Yeah,
yes.
I have one.
I've got one.
Which I probably shouldn't have just done.
We don't have one, Grace. No.
Oh,
we
really?
Have no CRTs in the house. They all went to an authorized collection center.
Yeah, okay.
I still
that
have
must
one
have made a really good sound when I went into the truck.
I still have one just because I can't be bothered replacing it, and people haven't said that it's dying.
No need to replace it until you've got
it. It doesn't get turned on much.
Well, that's all right. They chew a lot of power and they generate a lot of heat. And if you don't have to replace it, don't bother. But you also find that the LCDs are a lot flatter and thinner and take up a lot less space.
Oh, that's true.
The computer I have it on is basically only for Dux, like it's a real old sort of Pentium 2, but all it ever does is Duxbury and embossing, so it's fine. It works.
Fair enough.
Interestingly enough, it doesn't happen with a lot of people, but my ex-wife is actually sensitive to the refreshers on the CRTs. And we actually had
Actually, that happens to more people than you'd think.
It happens it happens subconsciously to more people than you'd think, and that's why you get eye strain and stuff. Usually the higher refresh helps with that, but Gemma used to be really sensitive to it, and even on the 60 hertz and the 80 hertz and stuff, she'd still sort of go, meh, this is not cool. So that's another reason why you might want to upgrade to LCDs. They're often a lot easier on your eyes, and if your eyes still work to a degree, that could be important.
I beg to differ. I actually upgraded a CCTV from a CRT and getting a whole new unit with a flat screen, and it was worse because the refresh rate was dreadful, and I've actually wanted to throw it out, and my old one's much better.
CRTs, CCTVs are a different kettle of fish because of the way they throw the image up, and we really probably don't want to get into this too much because Grace has got a lot more to cover and she's sighing at me.
No, it's okay. I'm just readjusting.
Checking. The CRTs, to actually redraw the image from a CRT onto an LCD is not really a cool thing to do. And it's usually not done very well, which is why it looks so bad. So you are right. If you're using a closed-circuit TV camera, you would want to be using a CRT, not actually an LCD. I'm talking about computer displays. I should have qualified that. The reason the CCTV is so crummy with the LCD is because the refresh rate of the LCD is 4 milliseconds or 2 milliseconds or whatever, so you can actually see the refresh as you rescan the camera. And that's why... CCTVs that hook up to LCDs haven't been popular because the high-speed LCDs make the CCTVs even more expensive than they need to be.
Fantastic!
In their defence, but I actually did have a third CCTV with a flat screen and its refresh rate is fine. It was just that one that was moving in between the generations was real crappy.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
These things take time to shake the bugs out of. I was actually having quite an in-depth discussion with the low-vision people at Quantum about this a few years back because they were bored at their tech outlook stand, and we were discussing the various merits and pluses and minuses of this technology.
All right. Any other questions on voltage, ESD? Does everybody know what we're talking about when we talk about ESD? Are there any questions about it, how it works? Any of that.
Do we cover what voltage you can actually feel in this?
That was in module 2. We can do it again.
Yeah.
Does anybody know how many volts you need before you can feel it?
Was it 10,000 or 30,000?
It's 3,000. It's, I think it was... Yeah, I think it was 3,000.
Yeah, it was 3,000. It was actually 3,000, Marshall's right. But it's only 20 volts required to actually kill things.
30.
It depends on what you kill.
20 or 30. Yeah.
It's 30, because they make the 30 to 3,000 ratio. So if you get that in any kind of Cisco test or CompTIA, 3,030.
Has anybody ever got out of a car and gotten zapped?
Who doesn't?
I have a fairly staticky fleece coat at the moment that I have to be careful
with. Yeah, those polar fleeces are bad.
Actually, be careful with that, because if you're holding on to cards that come out of your braille sense, you might fry them. I'm serious.
Apparently they're having quite a bit of trouble with static discharge starting fires at gas stations.
That's always been an issue. Because what people will do is they'll start the gas going and then get back in their car and slide against the upholstery or, you know, whatever is on the door and then create spark and things go bang.
Sorry, what else is staticky, Karen?
If you haven't tried it, you need to. A trampoline.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they do.
The other thing you can do as well is if you've got a cat, if you get an ebony rod and rub it against the cat, you can then use the ebony rod to pick up bits of paper. And usually the cat doesn't mind too much.
Oh, no way!
Wow!
That's cool.
An ebony rod? I'm trying to think what that would... I've never heard of it.
It's wood. It's a wood. It's a black wood.
Oh, okay.
But it needs to be ebony because it's that specific wood stuff that actually causes the electron shift. And a cat.
Fair enough.
I've got both of those. My daughter's name's Ebony and we've got a cat.
Oh, okay.
But seriously, guys, this is just very quickly before we finish on ESD. Just keep an eye on static and stuff. If you sort of scuff your feet along the carpet and then touch the bookshelf and there's this amazing crack that, you know, everybody can hear across the entire library, that's probably not the room in which you want to be fixing computer components and switching out RAM and stuff, okay? So just keep an eye on that because a lot of carpet is nylon and stuff and does build up the charge on, or even the wool and rubber will build up quite a high charge. So if you're sort of wandering around and zapping yourself on bits of metal, I would either be getting yourself an anti-static wrist strap or, and or anti-static mats to work in that environment, or find somewhere else that has flooring that isn't going to be so likely to build up the juice.
A lot of us have, some of us blind people, I'm guilty some of the time, scuff our feet a lot when we walk because it gives us more information about our environment. We need to, when we're working on a computer, be very aware of how we move our feet if we're working on a carpeted surface. So
that's like that advertising thing for the iPod Shuffle where they said, now you can shuffle with everyone else. I was like, wow.
That's pretty bad. That's something an O&M specialist got out of me very, very quickly from a very young age.
Oh, yeah.
The toe walking thing.
They really tried, but I just couldn't get putting my heel down first until I was in college. So, yeah. Anyway. So, did you guys know, I'm sure you did, that computer components contain hazardous materials that can harm the environment? Yeah, thought so. All right. Make sure to dispose of them properly to avoid this. A computer recycling warehouse is a place where discarded computer equipment can be taken apart. Computer parts that are still usable can be recycled for repairing other equipment. They must adhere to local laws for disposing of waste. That means once you drop that off, they're in charge of the regulations and laws. You don't have to worry about disposing of it once you hand it over to them. So that can be a good thing for you to do if you are not sure you quite know the laws on disposing of your equipment. Does anyone know of any of these recycling centers in their area? Because I've honestly never heard of these in any of the areas I've lived.
I know Staples will recycle printer toner cartridges because our company gives the toner cartridges that we get from them back to them and they recycle.
Yeah.
In Australia, Planet Salt Lake does it too. Ah, okay.
We actually have designated days at our regular recycling depots for what they call hazardous equipment. We also just got, of course, a provincial levy on any new computer equipment that's purchased for what are, depending on, let's say it's $1 or $3 or things, for a recycling fee.
Okay.
I've noticed on Asus's website, we've just ordered new quad-core AMD 3.13 gigahertz machines.
Woo-hoo!
Yay us. And the actual board says that it adheres to all of the EU regulations on ROHS recycling, apparently. And you look at all the box and stuff, and it does look like if you get it in the rain, the whole thing will just decompose and fall to pieces. I hope that's not true for the board as well, but it obviously...
I know of a... Oh, no, never.
Okay.
Yeah, and a lot of equipment now comes... What was it I bought? Oh, yeah, for somebody, I bought one of those Synology disk storage things. And it came with no styrofoam. It was all the sort of paper packing that was actually kind of cool, but it went on at length in the website about how it was using environmentally friendly packaging.
So did the Linksys NSLU2,
that
real papery stuff.
Yeah.
And so did all of the Linksys switches that I bought, the GS1008s that I bought three of. They all had that sort of papery stuff. And I will have a talk to you off lecture about how you found the Synology, because I've been wondering what people thought of those, but we'll get to that another time.
Okay, another thing that you guys can... Sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm done for now.
Okay, cool, cool. All right, so another thing about recycling Enviro stuff. There are these packing peanuts. They're soft and they're squishy and they're not quite styrofoam. These are actually made out of, like, cornstarch.
You can eat them.
You can eat them.
Was it you that was eating them, or was it somebody else?
I don't know why I decided to put one in my mouth, and all of a sudden it dissolved, and I was very surprised when I was younger at my dad's.
I wasn't sure whether you ate them, but I somebody at my house would actually go around and eat the packing peanuts. They would snack
on
them.
I only did that once. There's a way of disposing these, so you don't have to throw them all away and haul them out to the recycling bin. It's totally nasty, but you can take them, and you can pour them into your sink, and you can put water on them, and they will dissolve into this goo and go down the drain. It's absolutely disgusting.
Yummy, yummy, yummy.
We done.
Yes. No, I can see how it would work. I have not myself actually done this, because it's just absolutely disgusting.
I have offered for her to dangle her hands in the sink full of gunk, and she has turned down every offer I have made, but I have filled it up with packing peanuts and made a sink of gunk and said, here, dip your hands in this, but not quite yet.
I can see why
yet.
She wouldn't like it. I don't think I would want to do that either.
Yeah, but you can, and that's a good way of getting rid of them.
It's actually
a really good cuticle softener.
It probably would be, actually. I think the other thing to keep in mind with those, and the reason I ended up doing it that way, and there are certain limits to what you can put down the drains, but this stuff is biodegradable, is because if you put them in the recycling bin and the lid blows open in the wind or whatever, they blow everywhere, and they can also fall out of the bin and go all over the road and not into the truck. So that's sort of why we do that.
And if it happens to rain, then you're just going to have that gunk in the bottom of your recycling bin, and you're going to be scraping it out anyway. All right. So remember that CRT monitors contain up to 5 pounds of lead. Other dangerous materials found in computers include mercury, cadmium, hexavalent, whatever that is, and chromium. Your batteries for your computers. Is it okay? Batteries for toys, remote controls, computers, note takers may contain nickel, cadmium, NICD, nickel metal hydride, NIMH, lithium ion, LiION, and lead. So we don't throw those in the trash unless
Ooh.
They are.
How many people have thrown their CR2032 motherboard batteries in the bin? Naughty, naughty. They contain lithium, and in fact, if you break them open, don't do this, and drop them in the water, they fizz. Don't do this.
Oh, really? Alex recommends not drinking the water if you do it. I kind of agree with him.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, okay. Now we're going
this
to talk about upgrading.
This is why we also do not bang batteries, drop them, put them in fire, etc., etc.
Yeah, be careful with your batteries. Treat them
the
kindly.
Actually, you know those...
has all kinds of things they say you're not supposed to do with it. I was absolutely...
You know those tiny little hearing aid batteries? Those little hearing aid batteries, the little round ones that usually go in, like, talking times and stuff? I knew somebody who threw that into a fire, one of the little tiny ones, and it blew the brick chimney off the top of their barbecue. That's how strong the explosion was. Now,
maybe not such a good idea.
For people who are bored after lecture, Google up exploding laptop battery and watch the fireworks as you go down the YouTube results of exploding laptop batteries. These things go up like bombs. They really do. And there's incredible flames ripping out the sides of these things. So you know how we always tell you don't put like batteries in your pocket with your keys and your mobile phone batteries? Don't do it, because they really do go critical, and if that mobile phone battery shorts out against your keys, you are in so much trouble.
The things you hold dear might not exist anymore.
Yeah, you could have flaming pants and whatever.
Yeah, basically. Don't do it. All right. Well, that's the fun part of the lecture. Now we're probably all going to go to sleep while we talk about upgrading hardware, which we basically talked about in Module 1 anyway. But we'll do it again. So you have a worksheet. You've got two worksheets. You've got 11.1, I believe. And 11.1 is the exact same worksheet as 1.1.2. So unless you want more practice at looking for jobs, you can seriously turn in the same worksheet and retitle it. And I will grade it and call it that worksheet, because it is word for word the exact same thing.
I think they were
don't
a little
know
different
why.
Last term.
No, they're not.
Because I remember you... Oh, really?
No,
I wonder why
they're
I did it
absolutely...
Again.
Because you wanted to? So just go ahead and return in that worksheet, because they are literally the same, just about the same thing. The other worksheet you guys get to do here is I told you guys not to worry so much about 1.4.7, because you'd have another chance at doing it again. And this is why I said get all the help you can and get us to help you on 1.4.7, because you will get to do this next worksheet in 11, which is upgrading computer components. What you're going to do is you're given the same information, and your task is to find a component with somewhat better specs. It has to be improved in some way. So you're going to find, you've got a table. It shows you the component that you already have. I think you find two components that are better, or one, I'm not actually sure. And you might, if it's two components, justify which one you'd pick and why. So, as I said, you get to do this worksheet basically again with 1.4.7. So if you have not completed this worksheet and need help and actually want us to sit with you and work you through the worksheet, that's fine. Just let us know and we'll do that, because you get it to do it all over again.
One of the things you will notice that if you go on certain computer websites, sometimes the name of the product will be longer than your attention span, because they try and include every little possible vital piece of information in the name of the product and make it go on, and JAWS makes it sound like a complete mess.
Absolutely.
The other thing we found out too, which is interesting, and I don't know whether we've mentioned this yet, we have discovered that apparently the board that was used in 1.4.7 has been upgraded to handle a whole stack of newer components. So when we wandered back to the Asus site, or when Grace wandered back to the Asus site, it turns out they had changed the specs on the whole board when she wasn't looking, and it's now certified to take a whole lot of different processors and components.
Making the lab a whole lot easier for anyone who has will have to do it in the future. Thank you, Marshall. He has saved for future students from a whole lot of pain you guys had to experience by pointing out that update had in fact taken place.
Now, this is worth mentioning, and we would just like to make this abundantly clear. We don't mind being told when we're wrong, and if you can prove us wrong, that's fine.
Please.
We'll update the bits and pieces to make sure that it is actually correct. We don't take it
and
personally.
And you're actually getting credit for it, for saying, hey.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like she just did that.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I should have one more look before I tell him that he's wrong on this. And I looked, and sure enough. There you go. It was right there, and he was absolutely right. So, go you. So, there you go for 1.4.7. Anyone who's having trouble, yeah, seriously, we will one-on-one try and help you and walk you through this. It's all good.
There are 1, 2, 3, 4 of us that could help you with that lab. I'm sure even Drew might put his hand up if he's around. He's around at odd hours. There's Sean, there's Grace, yeah. There's me, there's Drew. There's 4 of us that can help you with that computer research lab worksheet. And we would rather help you with it than have you not do it. Because believe me, it's a really handy skill to have.
And your labs are worth a whole lot more than when I took the
30% of your grade.
It really behooved you to do it.
Yeah.
Fluffy, yeah, you can't graduate.
And most people have on this. I'm more talking to people on the recording who are listening to the recordings later who are struggling or whatever. So there are quite a few people who have had trouble with it. Another thing about these new labs, once you get to 11, as we said, we'll walk you through all of these sort of labs. And after 11, or you know, at this chapter, we'll still help you. But instead of probably walking you through it and doing what we have been, before we do that, we might start asking you questions as to how you think you'd find out the information that you'd ask us for. Or have you do some critical thinking to figure out what you need to know. We'll still help you if you're really stuck, and we'll still walk you through stuff if that's what needs to happen. But you're going to get more questions back from us than answers to help you guys think about what you need, because these are the advanced modules.
I realize I'm going to go to hell for the following question, but is it possible to use Research It to find computer components, or should I just not even suggest that?
I don't believe so. No.
Actually, hang on. If you got the blind bargains bit, then you probably could, because they have a Research It module that's analogous to the WindowEyes product search script, and if you got that and could get it to fly, theoretically you could. Because they have the script that searches, like, the thing that searches, like, 95,000 exaggerated number of stores and so on.
Oh,
so you might actually be able to do it.
There is actually a blind bargains module for Research It for JAWS, for anybody who's using JAWS. And whilst Australians might go, what would I want with blind bargains? They do actually sell a whole lot of excess stuff, and if you really want them to, they'll ship out here.
They totally will.
However, it can be useful for finding bits and pieces and components and stuff. It might be worth having a look at that. There are actually modules you can plug in.
They also have a WindowEyes script, and they have their regular website. So
that'll apply to four Australians.
The other thing to be alert, and I just discovered it today when people called me about it, is any of the Research modules that depend on Google seem to be hard linked to google.com. Now, I don't know how it is in Australia, but here, if you query Google, you get .ca by default, which is different enough that most of these research modules, that are dependent on Google, are broke when you use them from Canada.
Oh, fantastic.
I believe if you go to google.com, I have to get Grace to test that, because I think it will actually break over here, because it does take you to google.com.au.
Fantastic. I'll give it a go.
I think the modules are somehow editable, though.
Not really.
There's a page.
FS didn't put the blind bargains one together. I think Sean Randall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they're two text files, but it's quite a lot. I sort of looked at it today because I was trying to fix it for a customer, but it's quite a lengthy explanation. You can modify them and build new ones and things, but it's fairly involved, it looks like.
If anybody does it and wants to share their work, we can stack them on QCAT, okay? Just so you know. I'm not saying anybody has to do it, but if anybody does, we'll host your work for you if you modify it to do something.
We should make one for getting your worksheets down from QCAT. That might be kind of fun. I don't know if we could do that or anything.
No, not really, because the research module is designed to return stuff from a search engine or whatever. Hey, has anybody played with the Bing support in Quitter?
I'll be right back.
It's apparently really cool. I'll assume from the zero response I'm getting that nobody has played with the Bing support on Quitter? Okay.
Don't even know what it is.
I've never tried it.
Okay, Bing is the Microsoft search engine. Yeah, because Bing, it's not Google or something, apparently.
People joke, it's not Google, which is probably not actually what they were going for.
Yeah. It's an alternate search engine, and sometimes if you want to see different results, you'll go to Bing. Quitter is the blindness-specific Twitter client that a lot of us on here use to use Twitter. And if you don't, if you want to know about Quitter, you can ask us off lecture and we'll help you set it up. It will talk even if you don't have a screen reader, and it will behave itself on your machine without a screen reader if you want to play with it, and it's kind of cool. It has no visible user interface except for when you're composing tweets and stuff, so it sort of sits in the background and does cool things. It has a Bing support, Celona support, Quitter support, and a stopwatch. And there will be other things that are added into it at some point. So, and I'm just filling because Grace has gone off
Google
to take
Voice
care of something.
Is in there, isn't it? Or
yeah, that doesn't matter if you're in Australia, though.
Yeah.
You are correct for the people on here who can use Google Voice. In fact, can't you guys... Isn't there something wrong with Google Voice in Canada, I read somewhere? Or, I mean, there's things wrong with lots of things in Canada, but wasn't there something you can't do with Google Voice?
Yeah, getting an incoming number that's based in Canada. You can only get a U.S. number. And even to sign up, you have to basically fake it into coming from the U.S. IP address. I had to do it through a proxy.
Ah, brilliant. Not that any of us would do that so that we could watch Hulu or do various other things. We don't have proxy servers sitting in other countries. Never. I set one up last week. Very handy. There
hey,
are
Terry,
actually...
I have a quick question.
Yeah, okay.
What are the next four chapters about? 12, 13, 14, and... Well, till the end of the class?
One of them is printers,
is
which we're not
advanced
doing.
Advanced operating system. 13 is laptops, portable devices, advanced of those. 14 is printers, which we're skipping. 15 is advanced networking, and 16 is advanced security. So
thank you,
Sean.
But we still have to take the exams on them, don't.
Except for
you
chapter
don't
14.
Officially. Okay. Do you ever intend to do A plus?
Probably not.
You don't have to take the exams on them, but if you were to take the exams on them, you would probably learn a lot, and it would probably cause a lot of the knowledge to stick in your head more than it otherwise would if you didn't do the modules. So we can't actually sort of stand behind you and, you know, give you a half Nelson and force you to do them, but it is a highly recommended thing to do. We can officially pass a student if they only complete up to module 10, but we tend to find that people enjoy the revision, so it really is a personal choice. And if you don't think you can do the stuff of 10 through 16, you'd have to talk to Grace about that, and she would talk to you about that.
Okay, I just wondered.
Marshall, I think you'll like what's in 11 through 16. Very.
I've already finished 11.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And guys, if you need help, it's okay. We'll still help you. We just might ask you some questions as to how you know. I can think of an example, and somebody said, what was it?
Oh, there's actually an unattended install lab in Module 12, if I remember correctly.
You don't have to do anything with it. Oh, yeah. No, there's some questions. A lot of the modules in 12 are these things where you don't have to do the labs to answer the questions. They're more critical thinking as to why would you do this?
I reckon we should have come up with a new motto. Students, please don't gripe. Just call us on Skype.
Something like that.
That's actually kind of corny and cute at the same time.
I'm just
time.
Trying to think of the example. Somebody had asked me a question about a laptop lab. They said, well, do you think I need an internal or external replacement for this laptop? And I said, well, what would you... Oh, no. It was, I don't have a CD drive to install this software. What would I use? And I said, well, what would you use if you were the technician in this situation and you didn't have a CD drive? What do you think you might do? You can, you know, we're not going to, you know, get you in trouble because you didn't do this lab the exact way that it required you to do it. But what do you think they do? And like, oh, use a thumb drive. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly it. So carry on.
Seriously, though, guys, if you have the money, and they're not that expensive, about $60-$70, if you can buy a USB CD/DVD ROM burner drive thingo, they're so mind-bogglingly useful to have. I've got two of them. Grace has got two of them. Actually, I've got three of them. Grace has got two of them. They are so handy, and there are some things
are
that you cannot install.
Are they certain ones that are better than others, or are they all fairly comparable at this point?
Yep.
To one another.
The other thing... Sorry, Sean, I missed the question because people were talking locally in the academy.
Okay, so are all of these CD external Bernie things, are they pretty comparable to one another? Are there certain ones that are a little better than others, or I mean,
there are
Hey,
guess what? You get a. Everybody gets a lab to research this. So.
Oh, that's right.
Your questions will be answered in your studies.
I would recommend the light on ones. They're quite good. Are they light on or LG? The ones that we've got, Grace.
We've got both.
Okay.
The Pioneers are the ones we don't recommend.
The other thing you can do, which Alex was commenting locally, is if you don't have the money to buy an external USB CD-ROM drive, which is probably a valid concern, grab yourself an external IDE hard disk case and mount one of the old drives that might be bouncing around your house into it, and you will have one. And that's only about $20 or $30 to get the case, maybe even cheaper. Mount the drive in there, and bang, you've got an external USB CD-ROM drive.
I haven't seen that work yet.
Oh, no problem. All right. So let's move on. Seriously, we have gone off on a tangent. I'm really sorry. All right. So, the first thing we're going to do in upgrade is the case and power supply. Now, I've upgraded a computer case a total of once. So this is not something you'll probably have to do. The power supply, on the other hand, is one of the most likely parts to go, and you're not going to repair it. You're going to take it to your local recycling center and get a new one. Right. So you need to make sure, if you're going to replace a case or a power supply, that you find out exactly what components are going to go on the inside of the computer and what components are going to be connected to the outside of the computer. Because you need to make sure that you have enough power and ports for all of these components. Once you've done that, it is time to get what you need. So you're going to pick out a case and or power supply. Make sure that the case, power, and supply use the same what?
Form factor.
Form factor, yes. It needs to be the same size, the right size and shape to all fit together like a nice little puzzle. Because if it isn't, you've just blown your money and you're going to be very sad.
Handy hint that is not course recommended, okay? If you're doing a lot of power supply replacement, I highly recommend an electric screwdriver. However, if you are not confident with an electric screwdriver and yours doesn't have Torx adjustment, don't do it. But I find mine really cool.
Yeah, Torx adjustment is a requirement for that kind of thing. I've wrecked many a screw by having the Torx too high.
I'm just lightning fast on the trigger. As soon as it goes, I just let go, and I've been lucky. I've got good quality screws, but yes, you can actually strip the ends out of the screws and stuff. It's not cool.
A lot of your cases come with power supplies. This is good in a way and not so good in a way, because your case might come with an inadequate power supply. Now, let me tell you a story about an inadequate power supply that I got. We got the Zaz computer. Now, these are cheap computers that I don't even know where they get the parts for, but they...
I do.
The computers.
It was a company that went into receivership, and they got like about 1,000 of these units from this company that had gone bankrupt off a few auction pallets. Sorry, continue.
Okay, so I get this computer, and we decided we wanted to change the hard drive, which we did, and it would not come up. Basically, what happened was we blew out the entire power supply because it was inadequate. We didn't really think. And there goes the power supply, which is no big deal because it was like 230 watts.
No, it was 65 watts.
Was it?
Yeah, it was really low. It was a really tiny little power supply. Remember, we were all in shock because it was like a 65 watt supply. We're just like, you're kidding me. This was on like a Celeron 2.6 gig. There must have been about like 5 watts of overhead that you could have gone up before the whole thing would have overloaded. It was amazing. And yeah, we tried to upgrade the hard drive to 320 gig Western Digital. Power draw was too high.
So that is why you need to make sure that your power supply can provide you enough power. So that power supply that comes with the case may be not such a smart idea. You do want to make sure that the power supply that you get has enough power and will fit inside of your case. It might be a little more expensive, but honestly, so worth it to not have it blow up.
It could also be that the power supply could be really loud that they give you with the case, too.
Not so much these days.
You can get the ones with the 80mm fans and some of them, but generally speaking, Sean, it's not actually the power supply fan that makes the noise, unless it's full of dust, and that's when they start going, but that happens later. When you actually fire up a regular power supply, you probably can't even hear it. It's actually the hard drives and the CPU fans that generate the noise, not the power supply fan.
Oh, okay.
The other danger with these case combos is my work computer, it was a fairly fancy Thermaltake case with a nice power supply in it. And when I had to replace it, it has sat here for 4 months with no left side on it because I am required to take the motherboard out in order to remove the power supply, and I don't have the time or the inclination.
Oh, fair enough.
The other thing I would recommend is if you're doing cases, go for some quality, because the cheap cases usually have sharp edges, and while some people believe that a computer isn't yours until you've bled into it, we don't tend to recommend that for our students. The other thing I would possibly mention is when you're buying a power supply, if you're doing it for a modern system, make sure it has enough SATA power connectors if you're going to put more than one SATA drive in it. We specifically, Grace doesn't know this, but we specifically ordered the power supply for our new computers so that it would have enough SATA power converters so that we didn't have to actually convert them ourselves with the adapters.
I sort of gave the thing a cursory look, but since Carrie was doing all the specs, I enjoyed not having to build a computer for once.
Well, Chris and I did the specs. We talked about it, so.
I'll probably get to play with the hardware, which will be lots of fun. Okay. Power supplies convert what to what output voltages?
Is it all AC power to DC?
It is. It is. Good job. You're usually going to get voltage of, and this is important, 3.3, 5, and 12 volts. The output is measured in wattage. So you'll get a 400-watt power supply, 500-watt power supply. Make sure that it's recommended to get approximately 25% more wattage than all of the attached components so that you have room to upgrade.
Okay, question. Does anybody know how the hell do you work all this out? Has anybody ever done this?
Nope.
You rock off to tomshardware.com, and it's got a power supply calculator, and you plug in all of your components and hit the button, and it gives you a wattage figure.
Yeah, it's good. As Carrie said, make sure it has the required connectors so that you can connect all of the things that you want to connect up to it. What time is it? 10:29. Do you guys want to go more, or do you guys want to knock off at 10:30? It's up to you all.
I can keep going for a little bit if everybody else wants to.
Have you got any more to go on with, or?
Oh, yeah.
You keep going.
I promised you guys 10:30 let out if that's what you wanted, if we were doing these.
Yeah, but everybody talks. I think we give people 10:30 let out if nobody talks. I mean, you know, let's...
Oh, that's awful. Then people won't talk.
No, we're good. Let's go.
All right, cool. Alright, so we are going to go on, and we're going to talk about replacing the motherboard next. I've done this a total of once because of the power supply that decided that it was done because it was 65 watts. Alright, we need to make sure that the motherboard supports all of our other components, CPU, heatsink, your memory. Because if it doesn't, you're going to be very sad because you probably just blew at least $200 on a decent motherboard that doesn't have the right sockets for you. And pay attention to the number and type of expansion slots. We almost got a computer that probably wouldn't have had enough expansion slots for us to expand beyond our current needs, so we decided to pay an extra $120 to make sure we could expand if we wanted to.
Just to clear the air, the board actually had two PCIs, a PCI Express X1 and a PCI Express X16. It probably would have been enough, but it may not have been because I probably want to load the thing up with sound cards and all sorts of other things. But for a normal person, that board probably would have been just fine.
We're just completely ridiculous. You need to make sure that the power supply has connectors that'll fit the motherboard, of course.
That's not as of course as you think. I actually had a power supply and a motherboard that had the extra four pins, so I actually had 20-pin connector on the power supply and 24-pin connector on the board, and I actually had to get a little converter cable so that I could actually power the board from that. So,
I just mean, of course, you want to make sure that it fits.
Yeah.
That was not...
Watch out, too. The Intel chips and the AMD chips have a different power-up connector. The Intel one is a square 4-pin jobby that's 12s and 2... I can't remember the exact pin out of it. And the AMD one's different. Most power supplies have both of those connectors on it, but make sure it has the right ones before you try and plug it into your board. Because as we discovered, if you don't plug in the extra juice Mr. Scott connector, the processor will not go into warp drive at all.
Different motherboards use different chipsets. Remember that a chipset is a group of integrated circuits which allow the CPU to communicate and interact with the other components. It establishes how much memory can be added to a motherboard and the type of connector on the motherboard. That's a test question somewhere. So remember that's what the chipset can decide. Choose a chipset that provides the capabilities that... Go ahead.
Does that also determine the maximum hard drive size that can be installed in the particular machine, or is that something else?
That's your BIOS.
Okay. Well, alright, never mind. Well,
actually, technically, you are correct, Sean. There is actually a certain range of SATA chipsets that won't handle LBA 48, and that can bite you, and that can actually be a chipset limitation. But usually shutting off the onboard controllers and jamming an adapter card in the slot will fix that problem.
Well, and part of it is asking about my mini, because it will only take an 80 gig. They claim it.
No, that's because it's a Mac.
That's a BIOS.
No.
I'm pretty sure that was a BIOS thing. Okay.
No, it's a Mac-y thing. Are you sure it'll only take an 80? I thought the limit was actually 137.
On the mini that I have, which is like the second gen, that's what I'm hearing. I should actually ask somebody at the store I bought it
check,
from.
Check, because I believe it's actually an LBA 32 limit. I think it's actually an LBA 24 limit, which means you can go to a maximum of 137 gig drive.
Well, that would be good.
Seriously, I'd save up for a new mini, because it's getting crusty. Yeah, or hook some external drives to it.
Anyway, we need to choose a chipset with the capabilities that your customer or you need, depending on who you're building it for. For example, you can get a chipset that enables multiple USB ports, eSATA connectors, surround sound, or basic video. Or you can get Sly chipsets, which allow two video cards to be on the computer for really swank video gamer people.
As does that, except it's Crossfire. But yeah, we've got that. We've also got lots of USB ports, including USB 3 ports and eSATA.
The slot that the motherboard has is also determined by the chipset. It provides a connection point and the electrical interface for your CPU. Make sure your CPU matches the motherboard socket type, obviously, because if you don't, you're not going to be able to use that CPU. A CPU package contains the connection point, which will be your pins or your grid for your pins, the material that surrounds the CPU and dissipates heat. This is a test question. Data travels from one part of a computer to another through a collection of wires known as the bus. It has two parts, the data portion of the bus, known as the data bus, which carries data between components of a computer, and the address portion of the bus, known as the address bus. This carries memory addresses of the locations where data is read or written by the CPU.
Bookmark 87 inserted.
Yep, and don't insert that bookmark yet, because we're not done with bus test questions yet. The size of the bus refers to the width of the bus. The size determines how much data can be transmitted at one time. A 30-bit bus transmits 32 bits of data at one time from the processor to RAM or to other motherboard components, while a 64-bit bus can transmit 64 bits at a time. The speed at which data travels through the bus is determined by the clock speed measured in megahertz. Remember that, guys? We talked about that in module one. Yes, I will do that. We'll have those labs put up in audio labs for you. A cable making is unable to be found at the moment. Oh, Curtis, you don't have to do those. If you're you're a discovery graduate,
It's actually in the discovery area if you want to find the cable testing lab, and I will link it across into the ITE one, but look, you've got to look under discovery under 2000 and the old stuff, audio 2007, audio 2008.
2009.
It's also been linked in there as well.
Okay. But if you're a discovery graduate, don't worry about it. You've done it already, I don't need to. All right, anyway. Any questions about buses? Because this is really important, and you'll see this in your test. I took the 11 test. There are quite a few questions on it. Okay. PCI expansion slots connect to a parallel bus, which sends multiple bits over multiple wires simultaneously. So that's our... they can all go across together, whereas serial, it's one by one. They're being replaced with PCIe expansion slots, PCI Express, that connect to a serial bus, which sends one bit at a time, but at a much faster rate. Choose a motherboard that has slots that will work for your current and future upgrading needs. So make sure that your someone just went and opened the server door and completely distracted me and lost my train of thought. Sorry. All right. So if your customer might need specialized things such as a wireless card that you wouldn't normally want on a desktop, and they'll also need a card reader that is put into the PCI bus for some reason, you'll need more PCI slots. You might also have a PCI card that gives you extra USB. So you might need quite a few different PCI card slots. Okay, scrolling. Expansion slots are used to add a variety of capabilities, such as video adapter TV tuner cards and video capture cards and NICs, which we talked about last in Chapter 1. Okay, any questions on any of that in picking out a motherboard? Cool. Awesome, awesome. All right. This is another component that you might actually have to replace fairly often, is your heat sink. You might need to replace it when it fails and it's no longer adequate for the current application, or it just dies and is no longer cooling your CPU. Now, if this happens, don't use your computer anymore until this is replaced.
You don't really have a choice.
Yeah, it'll just die. So you also might need to buy a new CPU. You need to make sure, of course, that it's compatible with the existing motherboard. Needs to use the same socket type and chipset. Now, where's the best place to find this out, guys?
The manufacturer's website?
Absolutely. Don't look in the motherboard manual, because there might have been an update. So you might need to actually look in the on the actual website, just like that motherboard that I had trouble with.
There was actually a problem where we were actually looking at this when we were building the new server for Kavi. There was actually a processor that was sent with it that didn't actually support the board until we were able to flash the BIOS. So apparently an older revision of the processor was needed before we could actually flash the BIOS and then put the new processor in. So, yeah, gotchas in that respect sometimes.
Before you actually put in a new processor, it's probably a good idea to flash the BIOS just to make sure it's up to date, and we'll definitely be able to support that new processor if you can. You may have to get a new heatsink or fan assembly because this processor may put off more heat. Oh, there it is. It says this manufacturer website stuff already. A voltage regulator module, VRM, is integrated into the motherboard. The voltage setting for the CPU can be configured with the jumper switch located on the motherboard or settings in the BIOS, usually now settings in the BIOS, I believe.
Sorry.
Go ahead, boys.
When you're talking about replacing heat sinks, as long as the form factor matches, I'm not sure what else your board
would
have to do.
That's not necessarily true. Because if you're, not the board, the actual processor, if you're going from a dual core to a quad core processor, you might need a more powerful heatsink.
Yeah, but he's saying you can source the heatsink and fan assembly in as long as it matches the form factor of the processor and has sufficient heat dissipation capabilities.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, like it doesn't have anything to do with your chipset or your... as long as the clips will fit into the places on the board.
That's all that matters.
And it's big enough to dissipate the heat. And the power connector, which I've only ever actually seen two, is going to fit.
Yeah, but the CPU needs to match up with the chipset of the motherboard.
The other thing you might want to be careful with heat sinks, and it's less of a problem these days, but there is actually a heat sink review site, I can't remember what it's called. They actually have recordings of how loud the CPU fans are, and they actually give you a dB rating in how loud they are, because there's nothing worse than putting a new... heat sink onto a processor, pressing the power button, and have your computer go, and you go, okay, back to the computer store for a new one.
And I could so see that happening to me.
I remember the bad building days of computers of 2001, when all of the fans were sleeve bearing, they were exceedingly loud, 6800 RPMs, and they howled. Does anybody remember the Pentium 4s with the fans that wind up and down like jet engines? Has anybody seen those where you start doing things or you load like Cisco Netacad.net and the fan winds up and it sort of starts off at and ends up at by the time it's finished and then winds back down again?
My laptop has a Pentium 4 and does that.
Well, this is actually worse. We actually had people at the council that I used to do contract work that point blank refused to work on their workstations because they all did that and wound the fans up when they got busy. And they're just like, we are not putting up with this noise. Have I showed you, Grace, how loud it gets?
Which one?
The Pentium 4 that we got back from Nicole.
No.
Oh, no, I'm gonna have to show you that. That's impressive.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so this is on your test tube, and it's honestly one of these questions that you look at the answers and you have to look again because it's so simple. What is a multi-core processor? Anybody?
It's a processor that has, it's a chip.
Lean closer, please, Marshall.
Sorry, I put my mic up out of the way.
No problem.
It's a chip that has multiple processors built on it.
That's absolutely right. That's the answer you want. It's a chip with more than one processor on it. That's the answer. That's seriously the answer to one of your final questions. So you're going to look at this, look at it again, and be like, oh my gosh, that is way more simple.
So it's two cores on a single die.
Multiple
cores.
Multiple
cores.
Sorry.
We're not saying dual core here, or triple core, quad core. It's multi-core, so it can be anything above one.
Yeah, because eventually we'll have like 62 in 10.
Yeah, basically. So that is a multi-core processor. These processors release much less heat and consume less power than having multiple single-core processors, like actually having two chips on one board, which actually need to be slotted into separate slots on the motherboard. Some motherboards actually allow you to have multiple actual processors, physical square chips. A multi-core processor is just one of those.
There is actually a technical difference between a multi-core processor and multiple single-core processors that we won't go into here. But essentially, multiple single-core processors have their own cache, whereas the cache is actually shared between all of the cores of a multi-core processor.
And we're actually going to talk about cache next. There we go. There is a type of super fast memory that you use to access your most relevant information and what you were going to do next. This area is called cache. When this area of memory is located inside the actual processor, it is the primary or level 1 cache. Cache memory external to the processor is called level 2 cache, but it actually really isn't, because now that cache can be right inside the processor.
It used to be, which is why they call it that. There's actually 3 levels of cache now, but I don't think it goes up to 3 on there, does it?
I think it does. It just says that now the cache is actually included inside of the processor. The extra cache installed on the motherboard is now called level 3 or L3 cache. These are much faster than main memory. In multi-core processors, the L3 cache contains duplicate instructions found in the L1 and L2 caches. Anyone can tell me what the speed of modern CPUs is measured in?
Hang on, we're just having a point of contention here. The pronunciation of cache is cache, C-A-C-H-E. Okay.
Everybody calls it cache in America, so that's why I'm completely, stuttering over
there. Yeah, but the interesting thing, C-A-C-H-E, cache, there's an E on it. Cache is C-A-S-H.
I remember in the olden days when my dad was reading about computers and he would say cache because he really didn't.
My poor brother used to call it cratch.
Oh.
Great. I don't feel so bad. So, can anyone tell me what the speed of modern CPUs is measured in?
It's easy, go.
I'm guessing megahertz.
That would be a very slow, sad computer. Gigahertz is right.
It used to be megahertz, though. Not too long ago.
A maximum speed rating refers to the speed at which a processor can function without errors. It's the top speed of the processor. Two primary factors can limit the speed, and that is the processor chip, which is a collection of transistors interconnected by wires, and there are delays created by the transmission of data flowing through the transistors and wires. As it changes states from on to off or off to on, small amounts of electricity are released, and the amount of heat generated increases as the speed of the processor increases. When the processor becomes too hot, it'll begin to produce errors, so that's as fast as it can go. The other factor is the front side bus. Can anyone tell me what the front side bus is? Do you remember from Module 1? Okay, then let's review. It's the path between the CPU and the various components, like the chipset, expansion cards, and RAM. Data can travel on both directions on the FSB, and the frequency of the bus is measured in megahertz. This is the frequency at which the The frequency at which a CPU operates is determined by applying a clock multiplier to the front side bus. For example, a processor running at 3200 megahertz might be used might be using a 400 megahertz FSB. And there is actually a question in quiz one that has you calculate or try to calculate and estimate this. 320 megabytes divided by 400 MHz is 8. So in this example, your CPU is 8 times faster than the FSB.
People would wonder why RAM has ratings such as PC3200 and PC2700. There is a calculation similar to this where you multiply the front side bus by the multiplier, and that will give you the speed at which the RAM has to operate.
Okay, processors can be either 32-bit or 64-bit. Now, here's a question that we got asked this week. If I have a 64-bit processor, do I have to install 64-bit Windows? The answer is, of course, no, because the processor is backward compatible. This refers to the number of instructions a processor can handle at one time. Of course, a 64-bit processor can handle more instructions per clock cycle than a 32-bit processor. It can also support much more memory than a 32-bit processor.
Could someone explain why a 64-bit processor will handle more instructions than a 32-bit? I thought, you know, one
does it really say that in the notes?
Yeah, that's exactly what it says.
I've never heard that touted before.
Yeah, I don't think it's right.
It says a 64-bit processor can also support much. It can do many more instructions per clock cycle, is what it says.
Okay.
It processes more instructions per clock cycle than a 32-bit processor. That's exactly what it says here.
That may be true. I wonder if that's only true in 64-bit mode, or whether it's only true in 32-bit emulation mode as well. For the last 5-6 years, processors have been able to execute more than one instruction per clock cycle. And it is quite possible that the 64-bit architecture does have more pipelines and stuff to allow that to happen. So I believe that if you've got a 64-bit capable processor, you do actually have more load store pipelines and stuff, so it can actually do more instructions per clock cycle.
It makes sense to me, because the data bus is wider.
No, that's got nothing to do with the number of instructions it can do at the same time. That just means it can move more data. It doesn't actually mean that it can chunk through more instructions, because the data bus isn't used exclusively for the instructions.
Fair enough.
So, yeah. We'll have to look that up, but if the notes say, we'll try and verify that. It probably can do more than one. There must be more multi-stage pipelines in a 64-bit processor, which would be why it can do more than one instruction per clock cycle.
If you look up X64 architecture on Wikipedia, you'll be able to find.
Oh yeah, you'll probably get more than you want to know.
I just don't feel like.
But that's what it says. No.
I'm not disagreeing with the notes. I'm just saying I'm going to have to do some research and actually track that down. But apparently, it can do more than one instruction per clock cycle. Some of the predictive execution stuff. When it came into like the Pentiums, for example, if you had two assembler instructions, add A, B and add C, D, the processor could actually execute both of those instructions simultaneously. However, if you had add A, B, add B, C, you couldn't execute those simultaneously because one instruction was dependent on the other. And some of that multi-staging stuff is important in optimizing how quickly software functions. And in fact, as we discovered the hard way, just try running JAWS on a single core processor today. You will have a very unpleasant experience.
I have done this, and I was trying to access the Cisco site. It's almost impossible.
Can I ask a question?
That's what I've got on my computer here. It's hyperthreading, but it's a single
core.
Does
it hyperthread? So, yeah, okay, then
yeah, but still,
if it hyperthreads, you're lucky. Oh, this one didn't even. It was bad. Okay, go ahead, Karen.
If it is backwards compatible, last night when I was installing iTunes, I downloaded the 32-bit and then was informed that, no, you need the 64-bit. Go and download that version. So it didn't look like it was backwards compatible.
Hang on. Let's clarify here. When you install an operating system, you make a choice as to which version of the operating system you install. Drew. Well, just because he's done it. 32-bit operating system, 32-bit software. 64-bit operating system, 64-bit software. just because the 64-bit processor can operate in 32-bit mode means that it can run a 32-bit operating system, and just to make life more complicated, it can actually have compatibility layers to run certain bits of 32-bit software on the 64-bit machine, except for the stuff that you really want it and need it to run, which then it will go off and complain and say, I want 64-bit.
Okay, that makes sense then. Because I do have the other thing, 32-bits working.
You do, but I wonder why, I wonder, and this is just a theory, is this why your Zoom text is blowing up, because it's not well tested on 64-bit?
This is quite
Zoom
possible.
Zoom text just sucks.
Yeah, I think it might be the fact that you're running a 64-bit operating system might be causing it to die horribly.
Yeah, I didn't know that either.
I thought that I did actually select 32, but I'm going to have to check it. How would I check if it's 32 or 64-bit?
Well, if it whined at you that it needed 64-bit software, yeah, it's 64-bit.
To actually check, to answer your question, there are a couple of ways. One of them is to run CCleaner. It will tell you whether you're running 32-bit or 64-bit. The other way, without running any extra software, is to look in your root directory, and if you have a program files and a program files 32 directory, I think, somebody correct me if I'm wrong, you are in 64-bit land.
It's going to be called program files x86.
Yeah, you can also look on the click on the My Computer icon, give it a right click, check properties, and it will tell you there.
I'm gonna go check that right now.
Okay.
There actually are, as I've discovered in the last while, major issues with Zoom text on Windows 64-bit. Some pretty hard crashes that are easily repeatable.
Fantastic.
In fact, depending on how much RAM you've got, I'd almost recommend going back to 32-bit. I mean, it's an absolute pain, but it'll probably make everything start working so very much nicely. I know, you didn't want me to say that.
But you'll be so happy with how much more smoothly everything goes that you'll just be so glad you did.
It's 64-bit. How do I change it back?
You
have to reinstall the whole operating system.
It's not a lot of fun.
I'll pretend I didn't hear that.
Okay.
How much RAM do you... depending on how much RAM you have...
Yeah, how much RAM do you have?
4 gig.
Okay, no, you're going to be fine. I would actually go back. You're not going to lose much.
But it is a complete backup and reinstall job, so we'll let you can cogitate on that over the holidays as to whether you can be bothered. But if you do go back, I would bet the Nullarbor or bucket of sand that Zoom text will behave itself, JAWS will behave itself, and most of the other things you've got will behave itself in a lot more stable fashion than they would have under the 64-bit operating system. So that's something to keep in mind.
That's also very sucky.
Also very quickly, we were talking about if you've got device drivers that don't have 64-bit drivers, if you've got devices that don't have 64-bit drivers, guess what? You ain't using them under 64-bit.
You can weasel some of them, but...
Some of them. But the one you really want to work, it won't. Because of Murphy's Law, won't.
I've got a really good theory here. Everything seems to be working okay, only just, so I'm going to let sleeping dogs lie.
Okay.
Fair enough. Well, there you go, everybody in class. Real live troubleshooting exercise right there, figuring out what the problems might be for Karen. So that is pretty interesting.
AI Squared was also rabbiting on about having problems with Core i processors. I don't know whether
that's true.
You know what I want to know is, why is this large print software so dependent on the processor architecture? Why can't somebody have written it properly in the first place? Like, seriously? Did we never think that processors would get any better? That's like the version of Digger that only runs on a 4.77 MHz XT.
All right. I think we're done for today. Quality issues at that company.
There's different sort of chipsets that make it break, and Office 2010 has all sorts of neat, weird issues. They need to do some major work.
Yeah.
These are the things that make me so glad that I am actually a speech user at this time in computer and computing.
Keep in mind, though, that we better not talk too soon, or there'll be some horrible thing with JAWS and 64-bit that we will regret we ever said that.
We had fun with JAWS in 64-bit. We had our fun, too.
Yeah. All right, I'll just hit stop.
This is a little
and...
bit about that arg...
What were you going to say?
Sorry. Well, it's a little bit like that argument of Mac versus PC users. It's JAWS versus
Absolutely.
Zoom text. And I find all the Zoom text people have problems, but so do the JAWS people as well. They just have as much gripes.
Oh, we do.